Welcome to The Deep Dive, where we plunge into complex topics to bring you clarity and those profound insights that stick with you. Today, we're embarking on quite an extraordinary journey into one of the most compelling and frankly tragic real-life stories ever told, Jon Krakauer's seminal work, Into Thin Air. We're diving right into the heart of this harrowing account of the 1996 Mount Everest climbing disaster. And, you know, we're not just here to recount events. Our mission is really to extract those crucial lessons about human ambition, decision making under, well, extreme pressure, and the raw power of nature. What makes Krakauer's book so uniquely impactful, of course, is that he wasn't just a reporter observing from afar. He was a client journalist, actually, on the mountain, an active participant who summited Everest and survived the very events he meticulously documents. It's this deeply personal quest for truth amidst trauma, and a powerful look at the limits of human endurance. Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah, and what really jumps out from Into Thin Air is how Krakauer challenges the whole idea of this disaster being just some random accident or an act of God.
Yeah.
His central thesis is, well, much more pointed. He argues the tragedy was the predictable, albeit horrifying, culmination of a kind of perfect storm. A storm of human ambition, yes, but also deeply flawed decision-making, and importantly, this growing commercialization of high-risk adventure. He really digs into why this tragedy felt almost inevitable.
And that why is just so powerfully conveyed because of Krakauer's unique position, isn't it? He wasn't just any journalist. He was an accomplished mountaineer himself. That technical understanding plus his narrative skill, it just elevates the book way beyond a simple report.
Absolutely.
He knows the mountain, the sheer physical toll, and crucially, he gets the climber's mindset from the inside out.
Precisely. He has this fascinating duality. He's an insider, right? Climbing with one of the expeditions. But he's also tasked with being an objective reporter for Outside Magazine. However, and this is key, that direct involvement meant his perspective was inherently subjective. I mean, it had to be. It was colored by his own trauma, by hypoxia messing with memories at that altitude, and in a profound sense of survivor's guilt. So he's witness, protagonist, investigator, and subject all rolled into one. This complexity gives the book this unparalleled, almost haunting intimacy, but it also forces us, the readers, to think about the nature of truth when it's filtered through such an intense experience.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And the book itself, structurally, is just masterful. It's not just a nonfiction thriller, though it certainly reads like one at times. It's also a deeply personal memoir woven through with investigative journalism. Krakauer traces everything, not just the events on the mountain, you know, the trek, the climb, that sudden storm, the grim aftermath, but also his own grappling with PTSD, the moral weight of telling such a raw story. It's a really holistic view of disaster and its human cost. So as Krakauer draws us into the story, he immediately sets the scene at Everest Base Camp. He describes it as the sprawling, temporary city just buzzing with aspirations. And we quickly meet the two main competing expeditions that become central to the disaster. Rob Hall's Adventure Consultants, known for being meticulous about safety, and Scott Fisher's Mountain Madness, led by this charismatic but maybe overextended American guide. And what becomes clear even in this initial sort of friendly rivalry is this concerning trend, the commercialization of Everest. It's allowing wealthy clients, some maybe without the deepest experience, to attempt the summit.
Right. And this commercialization, as Krakauer points out, it fundamentally changed the dynamics of high-altitude climbing.
Mm-hmm.
The cost alone, you mentioned upwards of $65,000 back in 96, that creates this sort of implicit promise of success, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Clients feel entitled, maybe understandably, and guides feel this immense pressure to deliver, even when conditions are clearly deteriorating. You start seeing this dynamic play out even in the early stages, like navigating the incredibly dangerous Khumbu icefall. And the effects of altitude, the headaches, the weight loss, that hacking cough, they were already taking a toll. You see early warning signs with key people, like Scott Fisher. Despite his reputation for strength, Krakauer notes he was already showing signs of exhaustion.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. After weeks of acclimatization, the book brings us to that final push from Camp Efto. Camp Efto is nestled in what they call the death zone, above 26,000 feet. There is just like, well, it's too thin to sustain life for long. Every single decision, every minute carries immense weight, life or death.
And it was right there, on May 10th, summit day, that the series of crucial missteps started compounding into catastrophe. First, the Sherpas, who were supposed to fix ropes ahead of the climbers, they were late, significantly late. This caused a major delay, creating these dangerous traffic jams. You had over 30 climbers stuck at bottlenecks like the Hillary Step.
Wow, just waiting.
Just waiting. In the freezing cold, burning precious time, and critically, their limited oxygen supplies. But maybe the most pivotal error, the one everyone points to, was ignoring the predetermined 2:00 p.m. turnaround time. This was supposed to be a hard deadline, right? Designed purely for a safe descent, yet almost everyone disregarded it, including the lead guides. Krakauer captures this fatal psychology perfectly. He writes, let me find the quote. Here. Above 26,000 feet, moreover, the line between appropriate zeal and reckless summit fever becomes grievously thin. Thus, the slopes of Everest are littered with corpses.
Chilling.
Isn't it? That quote just crystallizes summit fever, that irrational, almost obsessive drive to reach the top, no matter the cost, even when all the signs are screaming danger.
And that summit fever did prove fatal. As climbers were still pushing up or just starting down, this sudden, ferocious storm just slammed into the mountain, plunged them into utter chaos. Krakauer himself, totally exhausted, oxygen deprived, he made it back to Camp 5. But he was largely unaware initially of the full scale of the tragedy that was unfolding just a few hundred feet away in that blizzard. So many climbers, including Beck Weathers, Yasuko Namba, they were caught out in the whiteout, disoriented, lost, slowly freezing.
Yeah, the book recounts these harrowing minute-by-minute decisions, or lack thereof. You have Rob Hall, stranded high on the summit ridge with his client Doug Hansen. He makes that final, just heartbreaking radio call to his pregnant wife before he died. Scott Fisher also succumbed. He got lost, became incapacitated on his descent. And then there's the whole controversy surrounding the mountain madness guide, Anatoly Boukreev.
Right, Boukreev. Krakauer criticizes him for descending ahead of his clients.
He does. It's a major point of contention in the book. Krakauer questions that choice. But to Boukreev's credit, and this is important, he later bravely reascended multiple times deep into the storm and ultimately rescued three stranded climbers.
That's just, it's such a classic ethical dilemma right there, isn't it? Is it better to save yourself, to potentially help later, or stay with clients to the bitter end, even if it means you all perish?
It's a brutal question.
Yeah.
And while Krakauer was critical of Boukreev's initial descent, Boukreev himself argued, quite strongly in his own book, actually, that it allowed him to recover. He maintained his strength, which enabled him to go back up and save lives he otherwise couldn't have reached.
A different perspective.
A very different perspective.
Yeah.
And it highlights that brutal survival calculus in the death zone. Krakauer quotes multiple climbers reflecting on that night, saying things like, "We were too tired to help. Above 8,000 meters is not a place where people can afford morality."
Wow. That's stark.
It really forces you to confront the incredibly difficult choices people make when pure self-preservation kicks in.
And amidst all this horror, there's the unbelievable story of Beck Weathers, left for dead, not once but twice, by his teammates. Miraculously, hours later, in a hypothermic coma, he somehow wakes up and stumbles back to camp, severely frostbitten, but alive. It's just an incredible testament to human resilience, though the cost was immense. Krakauer himself, as you mentioned, grapples with this profound survivor's guilt. He recounts events he believed were true, like witnessing the death of fellow guide Andy Harris, only to find out later his hypoxia-addled memory was wrong. Harris hadn't died where Krakauer thought.
Right. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this whole phenomenon of fragmented contradictory memories, clouded by hypoxia, by trauma, it really profoundly challenges our whole notion of objective truth in these kinds of high-stakes situations.
Yeah.
It just shows how incredibly difficult it is to construct a single definitive narrative when everyone's perception is compromised by physiology, by fear, by this sheer chaos. Our minds, maybe even more than our bodies, are just so fragile under that kind of duress.
So, pulling back from the mountain itself, what does this all mean for us? What are the core lessons we can take from this deep dive into thin air? Let's start with that commercialization aspect you brought up earlier. What do you see as the most significant unintended consequence of Everest becoming, well, a business?
For me, it's that subtle but really dangerous shift in responsibility and expectation. When clients are paying these huge sums, like $65,000, they naturally, maybe even reasonably, expect to summit.
Sure.
And this creates this unspoken but intense pressure on the guides. Even really experienced ones like Rob Hall, pressure to compromise their own strict safety rules. It's almost a perfect real-world example of the sunk cost fallacy, you know?
Explain that a bit.
Well, the immense investment, not just money, but time, training, emotional energy, it makes it almost psychologically impossible to turn back, even when prudence screams that you should. Mm-hmm. And this isn't just on mountains, right? You see it in business projects, personal goals, even relationships sometimes. We keep pushing forward because we've already invested so much, we can't waste it.
That makes sense. And that leads directly into leadership failures, doesn't it? You mentioned Rob Hall, known for being meticulous about safety, yet he famously broke his own 2 p.m. turnaround rule. He did it for his client, Doug Hansen, who was desperately close, on his second attempt. It feels like a textbook case of what some call normalization of deviance. How do these small compromises become so dangerous?
Exactly that. Normalization of deviance. It's when these small deviations from established safety protocols or rules gradually become accepted as the new norm. On Everest that day, maybe it was starting a little late, then the ropes were a bit late, then pushing just a little past the turnaround time.
Each one seems minor on its own.
Right. Each individual compromise seems justifiable, maybe even necessary in the moment. But cumulatively, they erode the safety margins and create the conditions for a large-scale failure. And this raises a really important question for all of us, I think. In what areas of our own lives, or maybe within our workplaces or organizations, do we see small compromises in safety or ethics becoming normalized? Setting the stage for potentially bigger problems down the road. You often see this pattern in the lead up to major industrial or technological disasters.
Yeah.
It's rarely one big thing. It's often a chain of tiny overlooked issues.
And weaving through all these human factors, the commerce, the leadership, the psychology is just the sheer awesome power and, frankly, indifference of nature. Despite all the advanced technology, the immense expertise, the planning, humans are ultimately so fragile up there. The mountain, Chumulama, goddess mother of the world, as the Sherpas call it, it just doesn't care about our dreams or ambitions.
Absolutely. The book is such a powerful reminder of that. There's a great line, sometimes attributed to climbers, sometimes to the mountains themselves. Mountains have a way of dealing with overconfidence.
That's good.
Yeah. It emphasizes that humility in the face of complex, unpredictable systems, whether that's a mountain, financial markets, or global pandemics, or even just our own big personal projects,
yeah,
is a vital component of true wisdom. Overconfidence becomes a profound liability. It's just a stark reminder that some forces are genuinely beyond our control, and respecting those limits is absolutely paramount.
And circling back finally to Krakauer's personal struggle, that subjective nature of truth and memory he confronts so honestly, his willingness to implicate himself, to admit his own confusion and potential errors, it's a really powerful meditation, isn't it? That in chaos and trauma, maybe a single objective narrative is often just impossible.
It really is.
There are only these fragmented, conflicting truths shaped by individual experience and the brutal physiology of operating at the absolute edge of human endurance. He doesn't try to make himself the flawless hero, which is rare and quite unsettlingly honest in an account like this.
Wow.
What an intense deep dive we've taken through John Krakauer's Into Thin Air. It's really revealed how a series of individually understandable human errors driven by ambition, ego, fatigue, can compound into a tragedy of immense proportions. It leaves us with so much to consider.
Definitely. And if we were to distill it, maybe the emotional insight that resonates most profoundly from this story is about the scars, the profound and lasting psychological scars that an experience like this leaves. It really demonstrates that survival isn't the end of suffering. Often it's just the beginning of a lifelong struggle with guilt, with trauma, and those haunting what-if questions.
That's powerful.
And intellectually, I think the key takeaway is the unreliability of human memory under extreme duress. And tied to that, the inherent subjectivity of truth. It forces us, I think, to question the certainty of any single narrative, especially one forged in chaos and loss. Our understanding of reality, particularly under pressure, is far more fragile and complex than we often like to admit. And finally, for universal insight, something practical. The book just underscores the critical importance of establishing and respecting turnaround times in any high-stakes pursuit. It's about cultivating the humility, the wisdom to know when to pivot, when to abandon a goal, even when it feels close. Recognizing when ambition is pushed past prudence, that prevents summit fever from leading to catastrophic failure, not just on a mountain, but in our own lives too.
So thinking about that, what turnaround times do you need to establish in your own life or work? How do you prevent ambition from blinding you to critical risks? When does that admirable persistence actually become destructive? And how do we cultivate the wisdom to know when it's time to turn back, even when the summit feels tantalizingly within reach?